Thank you, Daniel, for that introduction, and thanks for the invitation to speak here, and thank you all for coming. It's very nice to be here. So before I get started, let me acknowledge my collaborators on the work that I'm going to be presenting. Most of the work was done with Xiaoling Qi, a professor at Stanford, and at various stages of the projects that we were working on, his graduate student joined us, and Yuval Mareg from the Weizmann Institute, and more recently, we've had works with Steve Killison and Eris. So one of the central questions that much of my research is trying to tackle is the question of what are the possible states of matter? What are the, in other words, what are the different ways that collective behavior can emerge out of a system of many, many particles? This is a question which is not only of intrinsic scientific interest, but a lot of times when there are major breakthroughs in our understanding of the collective behavior of matter, this can lead to new technologies. And once in a while, if we're very lucky, this can lead to new insights into high energy physics, such as the origin of matter, the fundamental forces, maybe even space itself. So before I get started, I want to give you some examples of some interesting and historically useful phases of matter, just to give you some examples of what I'm talking about. A nice example is a liquid crystal. A liquid crystal consists of rod-shaped molecules, which will spontaneously orient themselves in some way, in some pattern. A liquid crystal, when you apply a voltage across it, will cause a reorientation of the rod-shaped molecules, which will change the way that light goes through it. And this has been very useful for developing electronic displays. Another famous example of an interesting state of matter is a magnet. Spins of electrons in a solid can, below some temperature, spontaneously all order in the same direction, leading to the phenomenon of magnetism. And this is useful for a number of reasons. One prominent example is you can store memory with magnets. Depending on, you can store a digital zero or one in the state of whether the magnet is, say, pointing up, the magnetization is pointing up or pointing down, and you can read the magnetization by measuring, you can read the data by measuring the magnetization, and then you can change it by applying currents. Another famous example of a state of matter that we think about a lot is a superconductor. A superconductor, you can take some various metals, like aluminum, for example, and cool them down to very low temperatures. And below some temperature, the electrical resistance will drop to zero, to exactly zero. And in addition to allowing current to flow without any resistance, superconductors will expel magnetic fields, leading to the phenomenon of superconducting levitation. Now, superconductors are very useful because the possibility of having currents flow without any resistance means that you can make very, very high magnetic fields. These are useful for magnetic resonance, which we use in, for imaging body parts, and for levitating trains and allowing them to move at very, very high speeds. Another famous example is a semiconductor. Our understanding of semiconductors is based on the band theory of electrons, and it was the understanding of semiconductors and band theory which ultimately led to the development of the transistor and LEDs and what much of modern technology is based on. I mentioned possible insights into high energy physics. Well, the idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is essential in our understanding of different states of matter, is one of the foundational ideas in how you understand a quantum field theory. For example, various particles in the standard model, pions, for example, can be understood as Goldstone modes associated with spontaneous breaking of chiral symmetry. The origin of mass, the Higgs boson, the idea of gauge symmetry breaking is something which is very closely tied to the phenomenon of the expulsion of magnetic fields in superconductors. And in fact, it's the same concept which appears in the gauge symmetry breaking in the Anderson-Higgs mechanism in a superconductor, as which applies in the Higgs mechanism in the standard model. The idea of renormalization group theory, or the idea that quantum field theory should really be thought of as a low energy effective field theory, which is one of the main ways that we currently understand the quantum field theory from a modern perspective, is something which was informed greatly by our understanding of statistical mechanics, by trying to understand basic phenomena such as how a magnetic impurity acts in a metal, and so on. More speculatively, there have been a lot of ideas that maybe even other things in the Standard Model and in our universe may arise from some kind of collective phenomena. There have been ideas that maybe fermions in the Standard Model may be emergent. Maybe gauge fields could arise from the gauge fields in the Standard Model might arise from the collective behavior of many, many interacting degrees of freedom. Okay. Now, when we want to understand the states of matter, there are two key concepts involved in doing so. The first concept is that we needed some kind of more precise definition of what a phase of matter is. And this definition is through what we call phase transitions. Two phases are distinct phases of matter if you have to go through a phase transition if you want to go from one to the other. A phase transition is a singularity in the free energy of the system. If you're talking about a quantum system at zero temperature, this would just be a singularity in the ground state energy. So for example, here I've shown the famous pressure temperature phase diagram of water. We know that liquid and gas are essentially the same phase because you can continuously go from one to the other without going through a phase transition, whereas liquid and solid, water and ice, are distinct phases. There's no way of going one to the other without passing through a phase transition. The second important concept is the idea of universality. This is the idea that the long wavelength, low energy behavior of some phase of matter may actually be independent of the microscopic details of its constituents. Okay, so for example, if you want to understand the hydrodynamic properties of water, it's enough to understand the Navier-Stokes equation and hydrodynamics. You don't need to care so much about whether your fluid is made up of H2O molecules or air and so on. So the goal, therefore, is that we want to try to understand the different universal behaviors, the different long wavelength, low energy properties of different phases of matter. And that's what we're after. Okay. Now, for much of the 20th century, our understanding of the different phases of matter was based on this paradigm known as the Ginzburg-Landau paradigm. It's based on the idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking. For example, a magnet, a ferromagnet, would be different from a paramagnet because one of them spontaneously breaks spin rotational symmetry and the other one doesn't. A solid is different from a liquid because one of them spontaneously breaks the translational symmetry of the system and the other one doesn't. The idea of Ginzburg-Landau theory is to identify some appropriate quantity, some order parameter, which locally describes the property of the system. It could be the magnetization in this example, or it could be the density of molecules or atoms in this example. And once you identify the appropriate local order parameter, you go in a regime where the fluctuations of this local order parameter are small, and the magnitude is also small. And this allows you to expand the free energy and powers of this local order parameter and its gradients in a way which is consistent with the symmetries of the system that you're thinking about. Okay. Depending on the parameter, different parameters in this free energy, it's possible that the system would want to have, say, some zero average value for the order parameter, or the free energy could develop multiple different minima at different non-zero average values for this order parameter. And the system, to stay in the lowest energy configuration, would therefore have to spontaneously break that symmetry. Okay, so this way of thinking about this idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking can be used to distinguish all of the phases of matter that I described to you earlier. It can crystals break translational symmetry, magnets break spin rotational symmetry, superfluids break a more subtle particle number conservation. And not only that, but this idea of Ginzburg-Landau theory and local order parameters can be used to understand the universal long wavelength behavior of these phases of matter, its low energy fluctuations. Now, what happened in the late 20th century or the early 1980s was the discovery of the quantum Hall effect. And this was basically a new paradigm in our understanding of the different collective behaviors of matter, the different phases of matter. What happened in the late 70s and early 80s was the ability to create purely two-dimensional electron systems. For example, you could take two types of materials, gallium arsenide and aluminum gallium arsenide, and put them together at an interface. And at this interface, you would have electrons which are bound to that interface. And at low enough temperatures, their motion in the third direction is completely frozen. So this forms a purely two-dimensional system of electrons. And then what was done was to apply a very large magnetic field perpendicular to the plane.
And then the resistivity of the system is measured. You can measure the longitudinal resistivity or the transverse resistivity, sometimes called the Hall resistivity. Okay. And what was discovered was that classically it was expected that the Hall resistance would just go up as a straight line. But then what was discovered was that for large enough magnetic fields, the Hall resistance developed these beautiful plateaus. And these plateaus were perfectly quantized in units of h over e squared. This is Planck's constant, this is electron charge, and this is n is an integer here. Okay? At the same time that you have the quantization of this resistance, you have these deep minima in the longitudinal resistance, which signals the fact that the system is incompressible and doesn't want current to just flow directly through it. Okay. Now, the discovery of these quantum Hall states was, it signaled the failure of symmetry breaking theory, because here you have different phases of matter. They're distinguished by a physical property, which is the quantization of the Hall conductance is different. So you have these different phases of matter, but what distinguishes them is not the way that they break symmetries. They all have the same symmetry, in fact. What distinguishes them is something else. So this was one of the first failures of symmetry breaking theory in understanding some collective phenomena in matter. So this led to two Nobel Prizes, one for the experimental discovery of the integer quantum Hall effect, and later for the fractional quantum Hall effect, which I'll get to. But before I get there, at this stage, I want to review some basics of the quantum Hall effect, which will be useful in the later part of my talk. So we have two electrons confined to two dimensions, and we have a perpendicular magnetic field. And so these electrons undergo cyclotron motion. If you ignore the interaction between the electrons, this is just a single particle problem. The Hamiltonian is P, the momentum, minus the vector potential squared. And you can exactly solve this Hamiltonian. It's a basic quantum mechanics problem. And the answer is that the spectrum splits up into what are called Landau levels. The Landau levels are split by some uniform energy, like harmonic oscillator potentials, or harmonic oscillator states, the splitting being the cyclotron energy, Eb over mc. But the point is that each Landau level has a macroscopic number of single particle states in it. In fact, the number of different single particle states within each Landau level is the number of flux quanta. It's the flux piercing through the system divided by hc over e, which is the fundamental unit of flux. And from this picture, it's very easy to understand the nature of these integer quantum Hall states. The integer quantum Hall states occur when you completely fill up an entire Landau level. You can see that when a Landau level is completely filled up, you have to pay some finite energy cost to add in one more electron. So it's natural to understand why you would have an incompressible state at integer filling. And moreover, you can compute what the Hall conductivity should be when you fully fill a Landau level. And you'll find that each Landau level contributes exactly 1 in units of e squared over h to the Hall conductivity. So this basic kind of single particle picture can be used to explain these integer quantum Hall states. But what was more surprising was when samples got even cleaner and you go to lower temperatures, what you find is much more structure in the quantum Hall effect. What you find is not only are there incompressible states at integer filling, but there are also incompressible states at fractional fillings of the Landau levels. And at these fractional fillings, you have a plateau in the Hall conductivity, just like in the integer case, and a deep minimum in the longitudinal resistivity. Okay. Now, if you think about it for a minute, you'll realize that if you want to understand this, you have to completely change your way of thinking compared to what I was describing earlier. If you fractionally fill a Landau level, you can always add extra electrons at no energy cost. So the non-interacting picture would predict for you that the system should be gapless, it should be compressible, it should act basically like a metal. But here, we're finding something completely different. It's acting kind of like an insulator with these perfectly, beautifully quantized values of the Hall resistivity. So this means that interactions play a very, very crucial role in understanding the fractional quantum Hall effect. And exactly what's going on in these fractional plateaus was, at least for the simplest cases, explained very early on by Bob Laughlin. Laughlin basically guessed what the right many-body wave function would be that might capture the essential long wavelength universal behaviors of these fractional quantum Hall states. So the one that he focused on was the most prominent filling. The most prominent plateau is at filling 1/3 over here. So that's the one that he was focusing on. And the many body wave function that he guessed was had this form, where z is the complex coordinate of each electron to the third power. This third power helps minimize the fact that the electrons want to be far away from each other because of the Coulomb repulsion. And it also helps satisfy the fact that because of Fermi statistics, the wave function should be anti-symmetric. And what Laughlin found was that this wave function had very good numerical overlap with the exact ground states that he could compute numerically for a three-particle system. And this gave him some confidence that maybe this wave function describes the right universal properties for these states. What I think was a more brilliant insight that Laughlin had was that he used this wave function to gain some understanding of what the elementary excitations would be of these fractional states. Laughlin argued that the wave function for a quasi-hole, you know, a little disturbance where you have a depletion of density, would be described by this wave function, where eta is the complex coordinate of the hole. This, you can see, makes the wave function go to zero whenever the electrons are close to eta. So it causes depletion of the density in that region. And Laughlin beautifully argued that not only would this describe the elementary excitations of this medium, but he showed that this wave function, this excitation, carries fractional charge relative to the electron. Another kind of way of seeing this would be to take your fractional quantum Hall system and poke a little hole and insert flux through that hole. When you insert flux, from Faraday's law, that creates an electric field going around the hole, which, because of the quantized Hall conductance, causes charge to flow outwards. And by the time you've inserted one unit of flux quantum, you've in this 1/3 example, you've depleted that region of 1/3 charge. Now, the point about this unit of flux quantum is that if you have a system with a hole with a unit flux going through it, you can do a gauge transformation to completely get rid of that flux. So in a way, so because of that, Laughlin basically argued that that's how you should think about the elementary excitations of this fractional fluid. And therefore, those elementary excitations carry fractional charge. Now, one of the most important points about this fractional charge is that this implies that the quasi-particles are topologically non-trivial. There's no local operator that you could apply in that region to create this fractionalized excitation. You see, all local operators are built out of electrons. That's the only degree of freedom we have in this system. And the electrons all carry unit charge each. So every local operator must have integer charge in units of the electric charge. And this means that a local operator would not be able to create an excitation with integer charge. But rather, what you need to do is you need to apply electron operators in some non-local fashion throughout the entire system, essentially, in order to be able to create a single excitation which has fractional charge. So the point is that these excitations are topologically non-trivial. They carry fractional charge. A year later, it was discovered that not only do they carry fractional charge, but they carry fractional statistics. If you take two of these quasi-particles and you adiabatically exchange them, then the wave function acquires some phase. And that phase that it obtains in this 1/3 example would be e to the I pi over 3. If these quasi-particles were bosons, you would get no phase. If they were fermions, you'd get a minus 1. So the fact that you're getting some fractional phase indicates that these are quasi-particle excitations which have fractional statistics. Another important property of these fractional quantum Hall states is that they have robust chiral edge states, which are gapless. Okay, so let me break that down. If you have electrons undergoing cyclotron motion in the magnetic field, in a semi-classical picture, you can think that near the edges, the electrons have these skipping orbits where they're hitting the boundary and then coming back out. Okay? And this is a simple way that you can understand why the edge states are chiral. They only move in one direction. From this Landau level picture that I was describing earlier, near the edge of the sample, there's some potential which is confining the electrons to the sample. Okay? So the energy levels bend upwards. And when those energy levels bend upwards, at some point they cross the chemical potential. And it's at those locations where you can easily add in electrons at arbitrarily low energy. So these edge states are gapless because of this, and they're chiral. Most importantly, they are robust. There's no way of getting rid of these edge states, no matter what you try to do to the system. As long as you have this quantum Hall state on the boundary with vacuum, no perturbation whatsoever. There's no matter how strong, no matter what you do, you cannot get rid of these gapless edge states. This is very kind of a non-trivial feature. Usually when you have low-lying modes in some system, as long as you're willing to do something like break symmetries, add disorder, usually you can get rid of them. Here, they're completely robust. They're topologically protected by the nature of the bulk state. Okay. Another important feature of these fractional quantum Hall states, which is going to play an important role in my talk, is the fact that they possess what we call topology-dependent ground state degeneracies. If you put a fractional quantum Hall state on a sphere, there will be a unique ground state with a gap to all of the excited states. However, if you change the topology of the manifold that it's on, if you put it on a torus, for example, there will be three degenerate ground states with a gap to all of the excited states. Most importantly, no local operator could distinguish these different states. Okay, and this means that no local perturbation can ever split these degenerate states. This is, again, a quite unusual situation. Usually, when we have states in a quantum system which are degenerate, there's often some, either it's accidental or there's some symmetry reason behind it. Here, there's no symmetry reason. The origin of this degeneracy is really topological in nature. If you put the system on a genus G manifold, the one-third Laughlin state will have 3^g different ground states. One thing I should mention is that the only thing that can split this degeneracy is by putting the system on some finite size. If you put it on finite size, these states will acquire some exponentially small splitting. But in the limit that the system size is infinite, these states will be exactly degenerate. And these degenerate ground states, they've been observed in numerical simulations of fractional quantum Hall states and other similar types of topologically ordered states, but they've never been measured in an experiment. Yes?
Protected, why does the size of the system matter?
So they are topologically protected up to operators which wrap around the entire system. So by topologically protected, we mean there's no local operator which can distinguish that state or split them. But there are non-local operators. That's just the sense in which we're using topological. So what I was saying was these degeneracies, they've been observed in numerics, but not in experiments. And one of the things I want to do in my talk is to propose some way that maybe these degeneracies could be detected experimentally. Okay, so what do we have? These fractional quantum Hall states, they are incompressible quantum liquids. They have an energy gap, but there's no local order parameter which can distinguish them. They're outside of the usual framework of spontaneous symmetry breaking. They are instead characterized by these more interesting properties, fractional statistics, fractional charges of excitations, edge states, topological degeneracies, and so on. The framework through which to understand all of these different properties, I'm not going to get into it, but I just want to mention that this framework is in terms of what's called topological quantum field theory. In the case of the fractional quantum Hall states, the field theory that we use to describe these states of matter are in terms of emergent gauge theories, and specifically for fractional quantum Hall state, in terms of what are called Chern-Simons theories. The mathematics behind these quasi-particle excitations is called unitary braided tensor category theory. Just like group theory describes symmetry breaking orders, here it's tensor category theory, which describes the mathematical properties of these excitations. So recently, we've been seeing a lot of close connection between what mathematicians have been doing in these works on category theory and what topics that are of direct interest to us as physicists. Okay. So one other thing that I want to mention as part of this review is the idea of a non-abelian quasiparticle. So let's imagine that we have some of these fractionalized quasiparticles and we fix their locations. In some cases, it's possible that the ground state degeneracy of the system, there will be some residual ground state degeneracy in that system, even when you fix the location of all of these quasiparticles. And this ground state subspace in this situation is non-locally encoded in these quasiparticles in the same way that the topological degeneracies that I discussed earlier are non-local. This is in the sense that there's no local operator which can distinguish these different states, and consequently, there are no local perturbations which can split these degeneracies. Now, if you have these quasiparticles, n of them, at fixed locations very far apart, the ground state degeneracy will scale like some number d to the number of quasiparticles. So this d is kind of like a measure of the average number of degrees of freedom of each quasiparticle. We call it the quantum dimension. None of these degrees of freedom are not local to the quasiparticle. They're somehow shared non-locally, but we just ascribe an average value to each quasiparticle. That's the notion of this quantum dimension. Okay. Now, when you have these non-abelian quasiparticles, you can braid them. And when you braid them, instead of getting just a phase like what we got earlier with the Laughlin quasiparticles, in general, we can now get a unitary matrix which acts in this ground state subspace. So that's the idea of non-abelian braiding or non-abelian quasiparticles. The fact that when you adiabatically braid them, the braiding is described by a non-trivial matrix, not just a phase. One of the reasons that we're very excited about the prospect of detecting non-abelian quasiparticles and using them is because of the possibility of utilizing them for quantum computation. You see, if we have this set of states, this subspace of states, which is inherently non-local, and no local perturbation could detect difference between them, then they're inherently going to be immune to noise and decoherence. So it provides possibly a perfect place to store quantum information. But not only that, the only way to manipulate this subspace, to have unitary transformations in this subspace, is by this braiding process of braiding two of these quasiparticles around each other. And this gives a unitary matrix that acts in this subspace, which is robust. And so not only can you store the information in a robust way, you can potentially also manipulate it in a robust way. So this is the proposal of robust, decoherence-free quantum computation called topological quantum computation. Some people are quite excited about it. We haven't yet detected non-abelian excitations, so it's not clear that this will work, but it seems like an intriguing possibility. So now I want to describe some things that we've done in the past few years. So to do that, I need to go back to this theory of the edge states, of the fractional quantum Hall state, but I need to make it a little bit more detailed. So the edge states of the one-third Laughlin fractional quantum Hall state, it's described by this Lagrangian. Phi is a scalar field, and it's compactified in a circle of radius 1. Phi is equivalent to phi plus 2 pi. And this is chiral. If you look at it, if you look at the equations of motion associated with this Lagrangian, you'll find that they describe waves which can only propagate in one direction. If you were to quantize this theory and look at the commutation relations of this scalar field, you would find that they do not commute with each other at different points in space. No matter how far away these points are, these quantum fields do not commute with each other. Instead, they have this commutation relation. The physical operators in terms of this scalar field are written here. The charge density is like the gradient of this boson phi. The quasiparticles are e to the I phi, where this A here tells you, it's an integer which tells you what fractional charge you have in units of one-third. So e to the I phi would be the one-third quasiparticle. The electron operator would be e to the I 3 phi. Okay, it's like three of these quasiparticles together. So what I want to consider now, yes?
Is phi a holonomy of the U1 charge, the U1 gauge field around the edge?
No. Phi is, you can think of phi as, the gradient of phi is the gauge field when restricted to the edge. That's.
So I think that's the same thing I said. Is anyway what I intended to say?
Okay, yeah, you're actually, I think you're right.
That is, phi is the integral of A when restricted to the edge. Yeah. I think you're right. So what I want to consider here is you take one-third Laughlin state, but you sort of cut it. You have this trench, and in this trench, you have vacuum. Now, because you have vacuum, on each side, you'll have chiral edge states. And you can have electrons tunnel between these chiral edge states. This is like backscattering between the different modes. Okay? So that would be described by this phi 1 would be one mode, phi 2 would be the other mode. So there's some interaction between them. And the electron tunneling would be described by this operator, cosine of 3 phi 1 minus phi 2. Okay? Now, if you have if the tunneling is very large, this cosine term will be very dominant, and it will prefer to pin its arguments. Okay, this phi 1 minus phi 2 will be pinned to some value, and so this operator, which is e to the I phi 1 minus phi 2, will acquire some non-zero expectation value. Physically, what's happening is you have quasi-particle, quasi-hole pairs. You see this operator creates a quasi-particle on one side and a quasi-hole on the other side. So this quasi-particle, quasi-hole operator, it condenses. It acquires a non-zero expectation value. So these quasi-particle, quasi-hole pairs are condensed along this trench. And the consequence of this is that if you take a fractional quasi-particle and you move it near the boundary, it can recombine with this hole as part of the condensate. And then a quasi-particle will emerge on the other side of the trench and can continue going. So effectively, what this does is it heals the fluid in such a way that a one-third quasiparticle can now just go through that trench. Okay? It gaps out the modes, and it reheals the fluid.
Can you explain again this interaction Lagrangian?
This? Which part?
This is, yeah, both of them.
So this is like a density-density interaction between the different modes. And this is the electron tunneling operator. Right, because the electron was given by this operator on a single chiral edge. So the electron tunneling is described by this operator. And when this tunneling is very large, it pins its, the argument essentially gets pinned. Or one way of saying it is this operator acquires an expectation value. Okay? And this physically corresponds to the condensation of quasi-particle, quasi-hole pairs across the trench.
Does that mean that the quasi-particle now?
Yeah, it means that when a quasi-particle comes near here, it can just tunnel through because it can just, the quasi-particle will get absorbed to the condensate on this side and it can re-emerge from the condensate on this side. So it can just go through. That's the idea.
There's some symmetry that prevents you from writing cos of phi 1 minus phi 2.
Right, cos of phi 1 minus phi 2 is quasi-particle tunneling, and if this is vacuum, you can't have quasi-particle tunneling. You can only have electron tunneling across the vacuum. OK, so now what I want to do is to make this slightly more complicated, I want to take two layers. OK, I'm going to take two layers, and I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to cut the system. And now I have these modes, the right moving modes from each layer and the left moving modes from each layer. And now I want to induce this electron tunneling. Now, I can do what I did before, which is just have electrons tunnel between edge states of the same layer, which are counterpropagating. That would be described by this operator. See, phi 1, phi 1, phi 2, phi 2. And when this tunneling is large enough, it pins these arguments. And these operators acquire non-zero expectation value, which corresponds to quasi-particle, quasi-hole pairs condensing across this trench within the layer. But now when you have two layers, there's something else you can do. You can have tunneling between different layers. You can have electrons tunnel from counterpropagating states of different layers. And that would be described by this kind of tunneling term. And that would want to condense quasi-particle, quasi-hole pairs from different layers. Okay? And the point is that I'm going to get to, which will be clear in the next few slides, is that these are topologically distinct ways of healing the fluid back together. In other words, there are topologically distinct ways of gapping out these edge states. Okay. The way that you can understand this is to imagine having alternating series of gapping out the edge states in one fashion versus the other fashion. So have these domain walls. If you did this, the system, it's like you cut the system, but along these dotted lines, along these dashed lines, you glued the system together in a twisted fashion. Okay? So geometrically, what that does is it basically induces a branch cut which connects one layer to the other. The domain wall is then the endpoint of this branch cut, which connects the two layers. Now, when you have a branch cut which connects two layers, what you obtain is a topologically non-trivial surface. One way of seeing this, maybe not the best way, but one way of seeing it is, simple way, is you look at this system and you imagine you flip the top layer along this line. And that takes you to, if you do this flip process, you can see that the system effectively looks like a single layer, but with a wormhole that's connecting the two layers. So I have a video here which might help visualize what I'm trying to mean by that process. Okay. So whenever you have these branch cut lines, you're effectively putting the system, instead of being now a double layer system, it's kind of like having a single layer system, but with a bunch of wormholes in it. You're changing the topology of the space. If you work through it and carefully, you'll find that every pair of these branch points, the endpoints of these branch lines, increases the effective genus of the system by one. Each pair adds a wormhole. Okay, so it increases the genus by one. So if you had a bilayer system on, say, a sphere, and you had two n of these branch points, or n branch lines, you would get to effectively a single layer system, but on a high genus surface, where the genus is the number of these branch lines minus one. The endpoints of these branch lines are basically these point-like defects which you've imposed on the system and which increase the genus of the manifold. So that's why we call them genons, because when you add them, you're effectively increasing the genus of the system. Now, remember I told you that if you have a Laughlin fractional quantum Hall state on a topologically non-trivial surface, you'll have a topology-dependent degeneracy. Yes?
An actual quantum
pulse. No, so you could think of this as we cut the system along this line segment and we re-glued it back together in a new way. So this is all happening in the bulk, but you can understand it by an edge picture where you cut it and re-glue it in a new way.
Okay. Could you explain again? I mean, you are tunneling between each layer. So what kind of interaction do you put across layers?
Well, so far I just added this tunneling between layers by hand.
So you just put it by hand?
Yeah. So I'm gonna tell you how you might actually be able to do it later. But
well, okay, so you're already gonna tell.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you know, this is highly reminiscent of things that were in the literature of quantum gravity in the 1980s and 1990s and 2000s.
Yeah. So
all this appeared first in 2001's quantum gravity. Mathematics and all these silver spaces.
That's right. Yeah. I'm aware of some of this literature, but not too much.
We can tell you more of it. Yeah, so what you're calling a genon, we call it geons.
Right. So I think there are some distinctions, which is why I have a different name for it. But yeah, it'd be great to talk about them. OK. So the ground state degeneracy of the system, if you have a high genus surface, the ground state degeneracy for 1 over m Laughlin state scales like m to the g. This means that if each pair of these defects, each pair of these genons, adds m degrees of freedom to the system. And so each defect by itself has a quantum dimension or average number of degrees of freedom of square root of m. So in the 1/3 Laughlin state, this would be square root 3. Okay? One of the important features of these fractional defects, these genons, is that they have localized zero modes for a certain class of quasiparticles. So I want you to think about the following process. Imagine that you're in one layer and you pair create. You create a pair of quasiparticles and quasiholes. Now, the quasihole can move to the left of this branch point, while the quasiparticle can move to the right of the branch point. And far away, you have a topologically non-trivial quasiparticle, which is a quasiparticle in one layer and a quasihole in the other layer. We call it a fractional exciton. This fractional exciton can just be absorbed or emitted at zero energy, but only at the location of this defect, nowhere else. So in a way, this defect hosts localized zero energy states for this class of quasiparticles. In terms of the edge theory, you can write down the operator which creates that exciton. That's given by this operator over here. Here I chose to put it in the right moving modes. And you can show this operator commutes with the Hamiltonian. It's a zero mode. But interestingly, it satisfies this highly non-trivial algebra. Okay, this algebra is called the Z, in the case where we have three here, the one-third Laughlin state, this was the Z3 parafermion algebra. It's a generalization of the famous Majorana zero mode algebra, which if you're paying attention to what's happening in certain directions in condensed matter physics, the search for Majorana zero modes is an intensely studied topic currently.
Sorry, so this zero mode you cannot define on a pure isolated two dimensional.
You can never create this quasiparticle out of nothing, if you didn't have this defect.
So you need a branch cut.
Because it's topologically non-trivial. It's some highly non-trivial quasiparticle. But at the defect, it can just be created or emitted. Okay. These defects are non-abelian in the sense that they have this quantum dimension. But the important point, you can now try to ask, what is the Braid matrix for these non-abelian defects? And this is where this mapping to the high genus surface becomes very useful. It turns out that the braiding of these genons correspond to these highly non-trivial surgery operations on the manifold, which are known as Dane twist. A Dane twist is something where you cut the system along some non-contractible cycle, rotate one side by 2 pi, and then you glue it back together. It turns out that the braiding of these genons exactly implements this Dane twist. Okay, and one can see that it's hard to see in real time here, but the idea is that we draw some of the non-contractible loops, see what they look like in the mapping to the high genus surface, we do the braiding process, and then we see what that loop maps to in the high genus surface. And that tells us that the braiding on this left side is effectively the Dane twist in the right side of the picture. One reason why this is very exciting is because it's known that there are certain types of topological states whose non-abelian excitations are not powerful enough for universal topological quantum computation. But it's known that if you can do Dane twists, they become universal for topological quantum computation. So this method of taking a non-universal state, taking two layers of it, and engineering this kind of defect will provide a way of making a state that was not universal for topological quantum computation universal.
So the charge of this gion, for example, one of them, when one-third quantum Hall state, is it one-third or?
No. So this defect does not have a well-defined charge. In fact, even its statistics is not completely well-defined. The overall phase of the statistics is not well-defined because this is not a deconfined quasiparticle excitation. It's like a confined defect that you've.
But you said you can give out a pair, which can go to the.
Well, you can create a pair of quasiparticles from this defect, but the defect itself does not carry a well-defined charge.
So if you look at that quasiparticle, what is the charge of that?
Well, that's neutral because it's a one-third in one layer and minus one-third in the other layer.
So locally, it will be one-third charge.
In each layer, with the two layers together, it'll be neutral.
Okay. So it looks like Laughlin quasi-hole, but you are saying it's not.
Well, it's a Laughlin quasi-particle in one layer and quasi-hole in the other layer. It's this combination.
So locally, it is like Laughlin quasi-hole.
Sure. Okay, so let me briefly give you another example of this phenomenon. Let's go back to the single layer Laughlin state and cut it. Before, I glued it back together with electron tunneling. Here I can glue it back together with a different type of tunneling, which you can see breaks charge conservation. So this is like Cooper pair tunneling. Okay, so like you create an electron on both sides together. This is another type of process that you can have at this edge if you were willing to break charge conservation. Now again, if this type of tunneling is very large, you will give an expectation value to this operator. But this time, what you're doing is you're condensing quasiparticle-quasiparticle pairs, not quasiparticle-quasi-hole pairs. And the effect of this is that if a quasi-hole goes near this trench, it will recombine with a condensate, and a quasi-particle will come out. So when the quasi-hole goes towards this region, it will go through and transmute into a quasi-particle. Okay? Alternatively, if you have two quasi-particles and you bring them together at this line defect, they'll just disappear. Okay, so this is another way of healing the fluid, but it's topologically distinct from the other way of healing it, because quasiparticles don't go to quasiparticles anymore. Quasiparticles go to quasi-holes when they go across this trench. Okay, this is a topologically distinct way to gap out these modes. So this was studied recently in the context of fractional quantum Hall and superconductivity. So these authors, after our work on the bilayers, these authors studied the single layer case with superconductivity, and they found a very similar phenomena where if you have domain walls between superconducting tunneling and normal tunneling, you can engineer these exotic defects with exotic localized zero modes and so on. So here it's kind of similar. You pair create quasiparticle-quasi-hole pair. Quasiparticle goes one side, quasi-hole goes through this line defect, turns into a quasiparticle, and far away you have a pair of quasiparticles. So in this case, the endpoint here acts like a source or a sink of pairs of quasiparticles. Okay? These are topologically non-trivial. They can only be created or destroyed out of the vacuum at the location of these defects. Okay, so more abstractly, what's going on here? What's going on is we have these things that we can engineer in these topological phases, which we might call line defects. You can have two different types of topological phases, and you can have a line defect between them, but you can have different types of line defects, which are fully gapped, but which have different properties. If you have two different topological phases, A and B, you can also have gapped line defects separating them. Or if you just have a single type of topological phase, you can have different types of gapped boundaries, which is kind of another type of line defect which separates a topological phase from vacuum. Okay? So this is abstractly what's going on, is we have these different types of line defects in topological phases, which we're starting to study. In the past few years, there's been some start of classifying the different types of line defects you can have in topological phases. A couple of years ago, this was done for a certain class of lattice models. Here it was done for so-called Levin-Wen models. Here it was done for quantum double models. More recently, for very general abelian topological states, we developed some classification of gapped boundaries, as did Michael Levin. And this is related to some somewhat earlier works by these authors, which was, they weren't really explicitly talking in terms of gapped boundaries, but it turns out some of the ideas that they were thinking about is very closely related. Once you realize that you can have different types of gapped line defects, you can have interesting point defects, as I've been discussing, because you can have domain walls between, or junctions between different types of gapped line defects. These are point-like defects. They're codimension 2, but they're not finite energy quasiparticle excitations. In other words, if you just took your state and you went to some finite temperature, you wouldn't just see these things come out. You really have to basically engineer them or find some way in which the Hamiltonian would want to have these highly costly defects present. So really, they are, you should think of them as extrinsically imposed deformations of the Hamiltonian.
Speaking, you could have a system which has phases A and B, and these could be dynamical domain walls.
If they were different phases, that's true.
Sure. So the distinction is a little bit artificial.
No, I don't think so. If you have two even if you have different phases, if you have domain walls, the energy cost to separating these domain walls, that I think will generally be linear in the distance between the domain walls. Anyway, I think that's at least the examples that I know about that's the case. So let me draw an analogy here. For symmetry breaking order, we have, like a magnet, we have these finite energy excitations for which are the spin flips. we can have line defects, which are like domain walls. You can have a up spins and then domain wall with a region of down spins. These line defects carry linear energy cost. So you won't normally find them unless there's some reason, like some inhomogeneities or something like that, which prefers the system to have this highly costly line defect. We can have vortices, which are like point-like defects. But in two dimensions, vortices have very high energy costs. If you want to separate two vortices, the energy cost will grow logarithmically in the separation between them. Okay, so these are vortices would be like confined excitations of some medium. So for topological order, most of the discussion has focused on the finite energy excitations, the fractionalized quasiparticles. But only recently are we starting to sort of fill in the analogs of these states over here. The line defects, the things that have linear energy cost to creating them, would be the types of line defects that I've been describing. And then you can have point-like defects, which again aren't just going to spontaneously appear. There needs to be something that prefers them to be there, because otherwise they would be confined.
Okay. I mean, the distinct from quasi-particles because they live at the end of a line defect.
No. There are examples where there's no line defect in sight. Like, there are examples of these realizations in terms of lattice dislocations, where the lattice couples in a non-trivial way. And there's no line anywhere in sight. It's truly point-like. But it's essentially the same topological properties are present.
But can you guarantee that you couldn't have a different microscopic description of the same system, which that is a quasi-particle?
Yeah, because I know what the properties of the quasi-particles are. No, there could be another phase where those point-like defects are deconfined. But that's a different phase of matter. Okay. Here, we have this phase of matter, but in this phase, you know, like the one-third Laughlin state, you can engineer these defects, but they're confined. There's another state where those analogs of those defects are deconfined. That's a different phase of matter. You have to go through a phase transition to get there.
Could you make this defect into intrinsic excitation somehow?
Yeah, you'd have to go through a phase transition to a new phase. And then they would become deconfined. Okay, so in the remaining minutes, I don't have too much time, but I want to describe an experimental proposal for possibly realizing some of these ideas. You know, one of the things that is very exciting about this field is not just the theoretical aspects, but one can also start to imagine situations where one could engineer these defects and use them to probe highly non-trivial features of topological phases of matter, which currently have not yet been probed. So it suggests some interesting new types of experiments that you could do. So in here, with the kind of experiment that I want to describe is the following. I want to suggest creating these line defects in a double-layer fractional quantum Hall system. So the setup is the following. I'm going to have two layers in the system. Each layer is a one-third Laughlin fractional quantum Hall state. This kind of double-layer state of one-third Laughlin in each layer is something that has been realized experimentally since the early 90s. It's a very well-studied system. But what we want to do is we want to engineer top and bottom gates, which are separated in the lateral direction. And we want these gates to deplete the electron fluid in the layer closest to it. When you deplete the electron fluid, you introduce these edge states. Here they'll be propagating, say, out of the board. And here they'll be propagating into the board. Okay. And the reason we have this lateral displacement is now you can see that the closest edge states are actually from different layers. So we can engineer a situation where this edge state couples most strongly to this edge state. And so you have this electron tunneling. And so the system, the top fluid heals into the bottom fluid, okay, in the way that I've been describing.
You want the tunneling at the edge to be bigger than the tunneling at the bulk.
That's not necessarily true, because in the bulk, the tunneling just needs to be smaller than the bulk energy gap. But at the edge is gapless. So, you know, then it's a question of whether the tunneling is relevant or irrelevant. But the tunneling can be, in principle, much smaller than, or sorry, the tunneling can be the same as the bulk tunneling, but it will only have a non-trivial effect at this edge, because the edge is gapless.
But even the bulk could change the bulk state, right?
Yeah, so the requirement is that the bulk tunneling needs to be smaller than the bulk gap. That's an important requirement. Yeah. Now, there's a natural reason why the tunneling will be exponentially enhanced near this edge.
And that's why I've drawn these fringe fields of the gates and the exponential, the wave function in this direction will extend out exponentially farther because the potential well has changed due to the fringe fields of these gates. So there's actually a reason for why this tunneling will be exponentially larger than the bulk tunneling. Okay, so and this is something which David Goldhaber-Gordon's group at Stanford has, this phenomenon of wave function extension due to a potential is what he's been using quite a bit to try to probe two-dimensional electron systems. So okay, this is one added feature that we're hoping will help us. Okay. So the point is that by inducing this one half of this branch line so far, you are still increasing the genus of the system by one. Okay, so you still have a topologically non-trivial surface. And it turns out we can show that these zero modes, which were exponentially localized to the system, remain exponentially localized, even though you have these uncoupled edges. Now, something that I think is interesting, but maybe much harder to do experimentally, is that one could also gap out this uncoupled edge and fully create this branch cut, if you'd like. Because the idea is once you've gapped out this edge state, you'll have a second order process where an electron can tunnel from here virtually onto here and then onto here. And this second order process, it'll be smaller, but it is possible that that second order process will also gap out these other further separated neighbors and thus fully make the branch cut. Although the point I want to emphasize is that we don't need this. This is just something to make us happy that we can create the full branch cut, but it's not necessary. We will still have these zero modes and topological degeneracies, even if we only make one of them. Yes?
Well, two questions. The second thing you talked about, doesn't that require some sort of fine-tuning of the parameters in the Hamilton interaction?
I wouldn't say it requires
You only connect the upper right and the lower left, but not the upper right and the lower right or whatever. You know, you have to...
Once these two are gapped out, if this is a dominant process, these two will be gapped out.
Yeah.
So there's no way that this is now one uniform fluid. It's gone. Then this electron can virtually tunnel onto this and then over here. That's the only thing left at low energies. So there's a virtual second order process.
It can't get stuck in the middle intermediate state.
No, this will be some high energy state with some excitation gap. So that's not going to happen at low energies.
So
the second part of the question, why is it that it suffices to have only half the branch cut?
Because you see, even with half the branch cut, the system is topologically identical to a torus, but just with some holes cut out on the surface of the torus. So I've drawn these non-contractible loops to try to help convince you of that. I can draw these two non-contractible cycles, and they map to these non-contractible cycles. And the edge states, which are propagating around, you know, due to these uncoupled edges, and then the outer edge states, will just map onto holes on the surface. So the topology is still that of a torus. You have two non-contractible cycles which don't commute, which is the essence of what leads to the topological degeneracy.
I mean, it's a torus with holes in it.
The holes represent the boundaries.
The holes are like boundaries, yeah.
But they are the representation of the boundaries.
Well, these holes are, exactly, that's right.
Are there other gapped ways to couple four edges besides clearing them up?
So if you have two propagating in one direction and another two in the other direction, you only have these two ways that I described. Or if you want to introduce superconductivity.
No, I just meant.
Yeah. So these are the only, and by distinct, I mean topologically.
Yeah.
These are the two.
So there's no term distinct
way
to couple all four.
That's right. As far as I know. OK, so I should be done, but let me just take a very brief moment to explain what I want to do once we create this setup. Okay. What I want to do is I want to show that you can actually measure the number of ground states in this setup. What you can do is you can give a finite size to this gate. And what that does is that it will split the degeneracy of these different sectors.
And you can model the different topological sectors by kind of a three-state clock, which describes the sector of the system that you're in. And you can bring the edge state very close to this zero mode. And every time you have a quasi-particle tunneling event, a quasi-particle quasi-hole hops onto this zero mode, you change the state of this three-state clock. Okay? And so one expects that by giving a finite splitting to these different edge states, then every time you give this quasi-particle quasi-hole pair the right amount of energy, which can be done by applying a voltage difference between the outer edges, you will enhance the process by which these quasi-particles can tunnel from one outer edge to the other, and therefore you should expect a jump in the current. Okay, so you'd predict that in this setup, you would get multiple peaks in the tunneling conductance in this kind of geometry, which would tell you about the number of different states. And so we did this calculation, and it's a simple calculation of the tunneling conductance. And indeed, we found that the tunneling conductance would have three peaks associated with the three different sectors. And so this three is the same three from that 3 to the g that I was describing earlier. It's the same phenomena. You're changing the topology and thus increasing the number of topological sectors. So this is a possible way of performing spectroscopy on topological states.
Why is the axis over KBT?
Well, so this is dimensionless. Yeah. Are you asking? Well,
I
wanted to plot it as
temperature, the width scale with temperature. Is that what it's saying?
Yeah, so if the temperature is larger than the energy gaps, this is all going to be washed. So you have these different splittings.
No, but the spacing between the splittings don't scale with temperature.
The splittings will have some temperature dependence, I think.
But your axis seems to suggest, maybe incorrectly to me, that it's EV over KT, suggesting that somehow V scales as T. Or no. So don't worry about it.
Okay. I'm not.
What determines the splitting is that exponential tunneling.
Yes.
Right.
Okay, so there are many other examples of these possible interesting point-like defects. For example, I mentioned lattice dislocations. A number of authors have studied those in the last couple of years. Various other types of lattice defects, so on. So let me conclude. So I think that this study of defects, line defects, point defects, and so on, is really a new chapter in our and our understanding of topological order and fractionalized phases of matter. I discussed how you have these point-like defects which are non-abelian, even in an abelian state of matter, like the one-third Laughlin state. They host these exotic zero modes. I suggested this possible experimental proposal, which you might imagine could be used to create these interesting defects and then probe some interesting features of the topological states. And one thing that I didn't talk about is, which I just want to advertise, is you could use these line defects, the properties of these gap line defects and boundaries, to do other things as well. For example, couple electrons directly to fractionalized excitations. And we've used these ideas to help develop some interesting experimental probes of what are called quantum spin liquids, which are other interesting types of fractionalized or topologically ordered states of matter. So these ideas provide what we would like to call smoking gun signatures of fractionalization in those phases. So thank you very much.
So, questions? So if you were to use this for quantum computation, say these parafermions or something, then you would move them around, and that would create some global change, some globally realized change to the state. But how would you read out such a global? To read out such a thing, you'd need some sort of global probe or something, or would you?
That's right. The reading out is very difficult. What you would have to do is some kind of interference measurement. So you could bring in sort of the outer edges and have them couple at some point, but have the whole path around this edge state enclose some number of these defects. And then you'd have to do some kind of interference measurement that would help you measure the state of the system. So, I mean, it's very difficult, but you can imagine ways using interference.
So interference between what and what, for example?
Unfortunately, I don't have a slide. It would be... That's going to help. You would have these defects, and then you would bring in the outer edge.
Okay. So this is physically distorting the...
Well, this would be distorting like some outer regions of the fluid, which would help you measure. And you can have quasi-particle tunneling along here. And then what you can do is you can start, you know, you can send in current here, measure current out here. And then you can measure the current as a function of various parameters and see, like if you tune the magnetic field, looked at the current, you would see oscillations. And maybe the phase of those oscillations could tell you about what sector, what ground state sector the system was in.
Can you mention about this smoking gun experiments to detect spin liquids using these ideas, defects, and edges?
Oh, so you're asking me to elaborate on that?
Well, just a bit.
Okay, so there's this type of quantum spin liquid, which is called the Z2 spin liquid, and it's described at low energies by Z2 gauge theory. And the boundary of a Z2 spin liquid, it turns out, can have two different gapped phases. In one of those gapped phases, let me just draw it. So the distinction between the two gapped phases is, abstractly, it would be whether the Z2 gauge symmetry is broken or not on the edge. More physically, it would be whether the fractional excitations, the spin-ons, whether they have condensed near the edge or not. Okay. So if you have a quantum spin liquid, you can have a situation where, say, along some boundary, you could condense certain particles. So what you could do is you could come in here with a magnet. And the magnet, if it couples to the boundary of this spin liquid, so suppose it's a Z2 spin liquid, okay, when the coupling here is very strong, this will prefer the spin-ons to condense near the boundary. And you know that an electron in the spin liquid can be thought of as a composite of a spin-on and a hole-on. Okay, this carries the charge, and this carries the spin. So if the spin is condensed at this boundary, you have a situation where if you have electron tunneling between the magnet and the spin liquid, so you know C dagger magnet and C spin liquid, this would effectively look like, I don't know if you can see, this would look like C dagger from the magnet tunneling into the hole because the spin-on is condensed. Okay, so this means that the electron from the magnet could actually directly couple to the hole-on, which is a fractionalized quasiparticle. So this means that if you sent in electrons, they would just coherently leave their spin at the boundary here and propagate directly through quantum mechanically as a hole-on. Okay? So the electron directly just transmutes into this fractionalized excitation. And once you have this process of directly coupling electrons to fractionalized quasiparticles, you can start to play with ways of measuring that. So I don't know if you're interested, but I can.
You need the voltage above the charge gap.
You need the voltage above the charge gap, that's right.
Are there interesting interfaces between different filling of fractional particle?
The short answer is yes. there's a lot of interesting phases. And I think we're still discovering a lot of new interesting phenomena. So, I mean, I can go into detail, but I'm not entirely sure where to start. But the answer is yes.
Are you implying that if I take a sphere
and
look at one-third quantum Hall effect, two lovely a quasi hole and quasi electron behave like anion? But if I look at the same thing in a torus geometry with genus G, they will behave like parafermions. Is that a correct statement?
No. What I'm trying to say is that if you had a double layer system.
No, that's what you described. But does it imply that if I look at quantum Hall states in complicated geometry,
No.
Local quasi-covalent, they will suddenly change their property.
There's a very special role played by this branch point.
I see.
And when you do this mapping to hydrogenous surface, you kind of lose the fact that this branch point plays a special role. Like it kind of just disappears.
So the edge states are important in your
More importantly, the fact that there's this preferred defect, there's something interesting happening at a particular point is what's important. And that is lost in the hydrogenous surface mapping. You don't really see, there's no preferred point on a torus, right? But in this branch cut situation, even though it's topologically identical to a torus, there is this preferred point, this branch point.
Okay. But you have huge degeneracy when you have genus G.
Yes.
Then when you move things around, would it acquire parafermion character? I'm just lovely.
Okay, so you have to be very careful what you mean by this parafermion character. If by parafermion, what I mean when I say parafermion zero mode is there's some particular location where a topologically non-trivial quasi-particle can just get absorbed or emitted. And in a high-genus surface, you don't have that. There's no really special location where a certain quasi-particle can just get absorbed or emitted. But the beauty of constructing the hydrogenous surface from this branch cut picture gives you a preferred point where that does happen. Okay, so.
Well, I had a different question, but just on a follow-up on this, I'm not sure I understand that. But I thought that the parafermion was this defect, this point defect. Is that not what you were saying?
I would say this defect localizes. It has a localized parafermion zero mode. I wouldn't say it is the parafermion.
Well,
it localizes.
But to
zero
see
mode.
That it were had this, you'd have to move the defects around. I think that's what your picture had.
So
in that sense, it is the parafermion. I'm asking, is that a fair statement or not?
It's a rather loose interpretation. I would say that the braiding tells you that it's non-abelian, but the fact that you can just absorb a certain quasi-particle at zero energy, you can just disappear, is some additional piece of information beyond just what is the braid matrix.
Isn't that just a feature of what kind of object this parafermion is?
Yeah.
A signature of what kind of...
Sure, yeah, but I would distinguish the zero mode itself from the rest of the properties of this object as a non-abelian defect. They're all intimately related, so it's kind of hard to really distinguish them, but I would say they're different facets of the same object, so I would...
Well, let me ask the question I was about to ask. So all of this is two-dimensional. Sometimes
yes.
You have doubled layers. But it's essentially two-dimensional. In a certain sense, which I could describe to you later, maybe, some of these topological, if you think in a sort of bundle language, the distinction between different anionic statistics and so on is not very robust. It's not topological. Whereas in three dimensions, 3+1 dimensions, you have the distinction between parabosons and parafermions, like you discussed. That, I claim, is robust, more topologically robust. That's just a background to the question. Is there any thought going into higher, 3+1 dimensional analogs of these things?
Well, I didn't fully understand the preface to your question.
No,
but the answer to your question, there has been some work. For example, our work on the branch cuts and getting some hydrogenous surface using these double layers and branch cuts was actually, there was a three-dimensional study of that phenomenon by Ying Ran and Andre Mazaros, where they looked at like two copies of a three-dimensional topological phase of Tor code, and they constructed these lines, these branch surfaces, basically, where the two different phases went into each other. So that was one generalization of this set of ideas to higher dimensions.
Well, even something like parastatistics, you don't even need to do something with defect, with branch lines and so on. I mean, just point defect, point objects can have parastatistics in 3+1 dimensions.
I'm not familiar with what you mean by parastatistics and
just
higher
like
dimensions.
You said.
Well, in higher dimensions,
it means that the exchange, the permutation operators are realized by a non-abelian representation.
But I thought that could always be,
group.
You could always describe that by an internal space. And there's nothing
wrong with
that.
Everyone always says that, but I don't think, but we can discuss about that. You could also describe what you did in 2+1 by an internal space.
No,
with just
no,
some
you
sort
can't.
Of globe, just sort of.
No.
Well, you could, I think, but
you
just, need some. Well, we can discuss that later. You need some sort of constraint.
That's the whole point. Is you can't. If you could, the whole field would be rather boring.
Okay.
Yes.
Is there any particular significance to the use of den twists, or is it just a convenient mathematical tool?
Well, it's the answer that comes out. You know, I want to ask, what is the Braid matrix? It turns out the Braid matrix is this den twist on the high genus surface. So you know, I would just call it that's the result. I wouldn't say it's anything more than that. That's the Braid matrix. It coincides with that. So you didn't have to. You didn't have to identify with a Dane twist. You could have ignored the fact that it was the same matrix you get from a Dane twist. But I find it useful.
Is it fair to say that the kind of correspondence between the sphere with this branch cuts and the higher genus surfaces is that you kind of map the Hilbert space of the original, say, abelian topological space or whatever, the base surface base together with the kind of excitations as these defects to the ground state space of some other topological phase on the higher genus surface.
Sorry, I didn't actually understand that. Maybe could you rephrase it or repeat it?
Yeah, I mean, for example, you can take just the simple example, the toric hold case,
yeah,
with these formic defects,
yeah,
which have these Eisen statistics. Right, and then equivalently on the torus, you would have the double Eisen phase.
The
ground state space matches the.
The ground state space with the quasiparticles.
Yes.
Okay, so that feature is actually not general. So what he's referring to is you can take a toric code and put these twist defects, these lattice dislocations. And the properties of those lattice dislocations are very similar to if you had a doubled Ising model and you look at the Ising particles in that system. It turns out if you try to play the same game for more complicated states, then actually there's a big difference in even what the degeneracy of the subspace is.
An example of more complicated?
Yeah, so you're talking about, so basically the question you're asking is if you have Z2 gauge theory and you gauge electric magnetic duality, that takes you to Ising cross Ising bar. And it turns out that the non-abelian quasiparticles of Ising cross Ising bar have almost exactly the same properties as those confined defects in the Z2 gauge theory after pre-gauging or after condensation. If you take the simplest generalization, that takes Z3, you gauge electric magnetic duality in Z3 gauge theory, the non-abelian quasiparticles on the non-abelian side of that phase diagram, their degeneracy will actually be like half of the number of states that you get will be like half of the number of states that you would have gotten from the lattice dislocations. So they're not totally identical.
Because all the states in these locations are not gauging bar.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a close relation, but they're not exactly the same thing.
With these parafermions, those kind of things, is there any analog of a spin statistics theorem governing those kind of objects?
I can answer that question in a few weeks when we're done with our new study. So the answer is yes, but it's modified. It's more complicated. I mean, there's not really a very well-defined spin of these defects, because they're confined, okay? But there's some algebraic theory that you can develop for them, which contains the appropriate generalizations that you need, which an example would be something like spin statistics. So.
The answer is not really, but sort of.
Are there any more questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.